Joint House Senate Transportation Committee will come to order. Today we have Congressman Obestar that is going to give us an overview on the direction that the federal government is going and the direction that his committee is hopefully going to take. For all the folks sitting on the inside here, when you go to ask questions, Nick will be around to hand you that little mic over there, and just make sure that it's off of the mute and use that. With that, Congressman Obestar, thanks for coming today and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Murphy, and Chairman Murphy, and Chairman Leader, and colleagues for inviting me once again to have a dialogue with you on transportation issues and the broader issue of infrastructure. Lewis Mumford, whom I consider and have many times called America's urban philosopher, wrote, "The city is the seat of learning, the academy of learning. It is the temple. It is the hall of justice. It is the crossroads where the great issues of civilization are joined." And that is what we are about in transportation, the crossroads, cities, where the issues of civilization are joined. Lately, those issues have been very much at risk. The Washington Post, writing about the proposal for extension of the Washington area metro service to Dulles Airport, put on hold by the U.S. Department of Transportation's Federal Transit Administration in a decision very similar to what they're foisting on the Central Corridor here. Post columnist Stephen Perlstein wrote, "The decision jeopardizes an initiative that not only would improve the quality of life in a region beset by traffic congestion, but would make it possible for the region to move toward smart growth. This is what happens when a society becomes so obsessed with cutting taxes and rhetorically running down government that it massively underinvests in infrastructure. Government isn't spending enough to maintain the nation's public transit system, let alone reflect the increased urbanization or environmental and land use benefits of getting people out of their cars." Another writer said, looking back, it is clear that planners in the 1950s were thinking long term. The vast, costly interstate highway system launched by President Dwight Eisenhower comes to mind. While defense was the non-economic justification, in reality, the defense highway system was an economic godsend for the automobile industry, the trucking industry, the oil industry, tourism, and the real estate development industry. But would a 1950s era cost-benefit analysis have predicted the consequences of constructing tens of thousands of miles of America's highways? And that is the vision that I urge upon all of us in the transportation arena, to have that broader sense that these highways, these bridges, these transit systems, our waterways, our airways, our railways, are the underpinnings of growth in a fast-moving, highly mobile economy and in a world environment, a world economy. The Texas Transportation Institute every year does a study of the cost of congestion. And in their report last year, the Urban Mobility Report, they found that congestion added 4.2 billion hours of travel delay in the previous year. It added 2.9 billion gallons of unnecessary fuel consumption. Combine the congestion and the cost of fuel, the delay cost U.S. businesses in the 65 major metropolitan areas studied by that report cost $78 billion. That means that travelers are spending a week longer in their cars than they would if they could drive at posted highway speeds. They're buying 3 tanks of gasoline or 4 tanks of gasoline more than they would if they could drive at posted speeds. And it's a moral issue as well, because the name of the Lord is taken more often in traffic on weekday morning than it is in church on Sundays. So I think we have a serious problem, and that very same study found that for Minnesota, congestion costs our fellow citizens $1.1 billion a year in similar wasted time and unnecessary fuel consumption. In a metro area the size of the Twin Cities, the average motorist pays an additional $683 a year in costs that could be avoided if you had a mobile transportation system. There is another adverse effect to congestion, and that is the cost of logistics. Logistics is simply the cost of moving people and goods in our economy. In 1987, logistics nationwide consumed 17% of our gross domestic product. But by the end of the decade of the 90s, that was down to just under 8%. That is a $900 billion gain in a then $10 trillion economy. You can't make that kind of money investing in the stock market, but we made those gains in reducing the cost of logistics by investing in highways and airways and waterways and in our ports, our Great Lakes navigation system, and in the railways. But since then, those investments have declined, as the value of the construction dollar has shrunk and as federal funding was held below the levels needed. For example, in the current law, the current transportation law, signed August 9, 2005. But 2 years earlier, this administration's own Department of Transportation recommended an investment of $375 billion to maintain the growth in miles traveled for passenger cars and trucks, and to upgrade the existing portfolio of highway and transit infrastructure. Yet this very same administration recommended only a $247 billion program. That's only sort of a stand pat, treading water with the previous $218 billion program. So then chairman of our committee, Don Young, and I launched an effort to put the $375 billion on the table, but the White House would have nothing of it. Eventually, we got a $286.3 billion program signed August 9, 2005. That's well short of what we need. In the current law, we directed the establishment of a commission to study revenue streams and the needs for investment in our highway and transit systems. That commission completed its report in December and testified to my committee on transportation infrastructure in January, just 4 weeks ago. On their report, by a 9-3 vote, with the majority of members being those designated by the administration or by the House and Senate Republican leadership. 9-3 vote, they voted in favor of recommendations, far sweeping recommendations that included a 25-40 cent increase in the user fee for the next round of transportation investment. And an investment by all levels of government of a combined $125 billion a year over the next 6 years in our surface transportation needs, both air, highway, and waterways and ports. We had a hearing on the commission's report. We took testimony from nine of the 12 commissioners, the chair of the commission was the Secretary of Transportation, who voted against the report. And she refused to appear with the panel. We had a separate day of hearing for Secretary Peters. But we have now launched a year-long series of hearings in the Surface Transportation Subcommittee on the various aspects of that report and continuing evaluation of the existing Surface Transportation Act. Now, what should be the thrust of our future investment? The American Public Transit Association. Let me come back to the logistics issue. While we made those gains, in the last 5 years, we've seen the pendulum swing the other direction because we have underinvested. We have not maintained the locks on the Mississippi River. We have not upgraded them to 1,200-foot length. We have not deepened the channels on the Great Lakes. Our taconite vessels are going out 7,500 tons light because the interconnecting channels in the Great Lakes, the harbors in the lower lakes, are 18 to 40 inches low, so our ships are going out light. That means the transportation cost of moving iron ore to lower lake steel mills is raising the cost of steel produced in the United States. Similarly, grain shipped from the upper Midwest through the Port of New Orleans for international export is moving more slowly, with higher cost, because grain moves in 1,200-foot barge tows, and five of the seven locks are 600 feet in length. They haven't been upgraded since the 1930s, and that means those barge tows have to be broken in half, send 600 feet through, send the next 600 feet through, lash them together, send them on, and do it all over again, so that a round-trip grain barge from Clinton, Iowa, to New Orleans takes 820 hours. That means the cost of moving soybeans, corn, wheat, and other agricultural commodities to international markets is driven up because of the transportation cost. And grain moves on as little as an eighth of a cent a bushel in international markets. And if you look at a map of South America, and that point of Brazil that sticks out into the South Atlantic, just below the point is the port of Santos, near Sao Paulo. That's the major point of export for Brazil's soybean crop, which competes with ours in the same international markets. They are 2,500 miles closer to markets, 2,500 miles further out in the Atlantic than New Orleans. They have a 6-day sailing advantage. They have a cost advantage in the international marketplace. And we have to be competitive. That's why I moved the Water Resources Development Act a year ago when I met with the committee. I laid out the committee's agenda that included the Water Resources Development Act, upgrade the locks on the Mississippi, build a second lock at Sault Ste. Marie, dredge the harbors and the channels on the Great Lakes, restore the wetlands in the Gulf states and the Everglades in Florida, and we did it. We passed that bill through the House, through the Senate, sent the conference report to the President, he vetoed it. And you took a leaf out of our book. And with a bipartisan, overwhelming bipartisan vote, 345 to something, we overrode that veto. In the whole history of the Congress, there have been 1,424 vetoes, and only 107 have been overridden. Ours was the 107th. That's how important infrastructure is to the country, to the underpinnings of our economic productivity. Now, coming back to the city, where much of our public transportation is concentrated, the American Public Transit Association reported that surface transportation investment in transit systems has generated $788 billion a year benefits to industries, businesses, and individuals in our major metropolitan areas. It's over $314 billion in benefits to businesses alone. The cost of the direct economic cost of those transit systems nationwide is $185 billion. So we have a net, the total investment, we have a net of $603 billion a year benefit from transit systems across this country. And transit is growing at a rate of 1 million new riders a year nationwide. Every new light rail project and commuter rail project in this country has generated 3 times the ridership originally projected for the project. In addition, it has every new project has generated billions of dollars in private sector capital investment clustered around those stops on the transit system. Now, that has meant that land areas around bus stops, but mostly light rail and circulator systems and trolley stops, is far more valuable than other land. Cambridge Systematics Economic Research Center estimated that each $10 million in transit capital investment yields $30 million in increased local sales. Each $10 million in transit operating costs generates $32 million. So you've got a $3 to $1 in return on investment for public benefits. And right here in Minnesota, the Minnesota 2020 report, Moving Minnesota Forward, and I've cited this figure nationwide, and I've been all across the country in the last few weeks. General Mills spent $650 million a year moving its product to market. Transportation cost. For every mile an hour their trucks travel below the posted speed limit, they lose $2 million. UPS nationwide, United Parcel Service, for every 5-minute delay nationwide, costs them $40 million. Overtime costs, penalties for late deliveries, other associated costs that add up every 5 minutes, $40 million. They're losing tens of millions of dollars nationwide because our system is congested. The Oregon Business Council and the Portland Business Alliance did an evaluation of that state's transportation dependency. Failure to invest in transportation improvements results in a loss annually of $1.7 billion to Oregon's economy and a loss of 16,000 jobs projected out into the future. That state is taking into their hands a need to upgrade their transportation systems. Intel Corporation, which is located in Portland, has moved their last departure shipment time up 2 hours into mid-afternoon to avoid the evening congestion hours in order to get their product to the airport in time for delivery to national and international destinations. That has caused them to shift their production schedules. Why? Because the local transportation network is not sufficient. The Urban Land Institute did a study of the value of residential properties located along transit systems. Their study on California in the San Diego area found that those transit stops enjoy a price premium of 17% above market rates. That is, if you're near a transit stop, your property is more valuable, your business is more valuable, your people are more productive. I visited the Dallas-Fort Worth area a year ago and viewed the Dallas Area Rapid Transit System. In the land of the pickup truck, they delayed for 20 years investing in their transit system. But finally, it was built, completed 6 years ago. They predicted 10,000 or so riders a day. Today, ridership is 62,000 people a day, 18.5 million transit trips last year, and the DART system, Dallas Area Rapid Transit, has launched on a 20-mile DART East investment for which already $200 million in private sector capital investment have been targeted, clustered around the several stops on the transit system. 40% of workers in downtown Dallas depend on the DART system, both the rail and the bus system, to go to and from work. Residential properties near the DART stations have increased in value nearly 40% in the 5 years since completion of the system. Their transit program also generates $46 million a year in revenue derived from transit for their school system, and $23 million also in benefits to their cities. In the last 5 years, we've had about a 3% growth in population nationwide, but we've had a 50% increase in vehicle miles traveled by passenger cars and a doubling of vehicle miles traveled by truck. That is going to continue increasing at a rate of 3+% a year. So while population increases are in the range of 3 to 4%, more than 4 or 5 times that much of increase in vehicle miles traveled by this nation on wheels. Now, if we're going to keep up with projected increases of freight tonnage moved on the highways and passenger car for the business commute and for travel and tourism, then we need to invest. But with those increases, 50% increase in passenger vehicle miles traveled, doubling of truck traffic, we have increased lane miles 0.65 in the last decade, 0.65 nationwide. That is not going to be sufficient to carry the 19 billion ton miles of freight that moved last year. Over $13 trillion of value of freight moved on the nation's highways. Now, I said a moment ago we're in a world economy. In 1968, China had 168 miles of urban quality, interstate quality freeway. 1988, 168 miles. This year, China has 22,500 miles of interstate quality highway. China has committed itself to $150 billion investment in upgrading their highway system. Build 55,000 miles of interstate quality highway in the next decade. Travel time for truck shipments from Beijing in the north to Shanghai has been cut from 31 hours to 14 hours. There isn't anywhere in America we've taken 17 hours of travel time off a truck trip. From Beijing to Hong Kong, further south in China, travel time has been reduced from 55 hours to 25 hours. I don't know of any place we've taken 30 hours out of truck travel in this country. That means their cost, their transportation cost of moving goods for export has been dramatically reduced, while ours is swinging in the other direction. China's just completed an investment of $200 billion in doubling the capacity of their ports, $100 billion in doubling the capacity of their airports and building new airports in the interior of the country. And if you were to go to the Beijing Games this summer, you'd be able to take a high-speed passenger rail from Beijing to Shanghai, 820 miles, in 4 hours on a 220-mile-an-hour high-speed steel-on-steel rail system. That's the distance of Boston to Richmond on the East Coast. Can't even fly there in that time in our country. India is investing over $50 billion in building a 25,000-mile national highway system to improve the competitiveness of their goods in the international marketplace. And the European Economic Community, I just met with the transport minister a few weeks ago, Jacques Barrot, said they are underway with an investment of $330 billion in 30 priority areas of their rail, highway, and waterway systems. We're all in the same market. We're all competing in the same place. If their transportation cost of moving goods and people is lower than ours, they win the race in the international marketplace. We can't afford to do that. So when we move into the next authorization period, and we're already, as I said earlier, laying the groundwork for those investments, we're going to move ahead with a major bill. We're going to start at $400 billion and move upward from there. And we're going to finance it, and we're not going to finance it out of bonds, which carry interest costs that you pay to that don't generate transportation benefits. We'll do it with the highway user fee. And we will also invite public-private partnerships. There will be a role for certain types of tax credit bond financing. There will be a role for other financial models. But the cornerstone has to be our highly successful, proven highway trust fund investments. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, those are a few of our thoughts.
Well, thank you, Congressman. You never cease to amaze folks with all the information that you have right at your fingertips. First, I just want to say on the Senate side, our lead Republican, Senator Jungbauer, is not here today. He wanted to have a sit-down conversation with you about safe routes to work and school and bike paths and kind of promoting a little bit of health into transportation. But he's over at the Humphrey Institute today.
Tell him he's on the right track. We should be burning 86,000 calories a year on the seat of a bicycle instead of 8 barrels of oil a year sitting in your car. And we should convert from the hydrocarbon economy to the carbohydrate economy. I'm all for it.
Well, Congressman, you've always been a biking enthusiast, and it shows. So. We're going to take a few questions, if you
yes.
don't mind. I think we've got the room here for about another hour or so. So if you want to stick around, that'd be great. And Representative Houseman and then Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You cited those impressive ridership numbers on transit, on all of the transit projects. And I think you said universally across the country, LRT and commuter rail. And we've heard them, of course, over the years. As projects are completed, they reach their goals, their ridership goals, far before the predictions. Why hasn't that reality changed the FTA process to reflect that? Why does it sometimes feel as though outdated assumptions are still used and that then are imposed on states as they try to make the numbers work?
Well, you're in very good company with that question, Representative Houseman. The same question was asked by Governor Tim Kaine of the state of Virginia and by his highway commissioner, Dave Eckern, who served us in Minnesota previously, on the Metro proposal to bring Metro Rail to Dulles Airport from downtown Washington. I cited the figure of high-speed rail in China from Beijing to Shanghai. Well, we now have capital-to-capital service from Dulles Airport to the capital of China, Beijing. But when you get to Beijing, you'll be able to get on that high-speed rail and in 4 hours get to Shanghai. But it'll take you 4 hours just to drive on a bad day. From downtown Washington to Dulles Airport. What are we, a third world country? The answer to your question is that this Federal Transit Administration has defied the act of Congress, the current law, in which we set standards for evaluation of transit projects, and they are subverting the law. for whatever purpose, I guess they just don't like transit over there in that administration. And exempted from consideration the factors that we wrote into the law, economic benefits of transit that I cited a moment ago, congestion avoided, air quality improvements resulting, quality of life improvements. Those are not considered in the Federal Transit Administration's cost effectiveness index. They refuse to invoke those factors that we directed them to do, and that's why the Dulles Metro project has been stalled, and why you're having problems with the Central Corridor here in the Twin Cities, because the Federal Transit Administration won't evaluate the comprehensive nature of a transit project. They don't apply those factors to highway construction. But they should. And if they did, some of those cost effectiveness indexes would mean some highways wouldn't be built. Mm-hmm. That's a one-sided view. And when we've had hearings on the subject already, and a bipartisan revolt against this administration over that issue in our committee. But when we come to the next transit, or to the next transportation bill, the transit portion is going to be written very tightly so any future administration can't subvert it.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Congressman Oberstar, thank you for all of your work. And I was very intrigued by your Beijing to Shanghai example, and it got me thinking about intercity rail, of course, here, and we have our proposals for the Duluth-Minneapolis route, and, of course, Minneapolis to Chicago. What's your advice for us at the state level in expediting these types of projects?
Go for it.
I know that they're all in our bonding bill, but
the last governor we had who was an advocate for passenger rail was Rudy Perpich, and the governor before him was Al Cui. Al Cui kept Amtrak funding moving forward, and Rudy Perpich did. He was a strong advocate for the Midwest Rail Initiative, funding for which, with his partnership, actually, his indication of supporting, that I put into the ICE-T legislation in 91 to study up to 12 corridors for high-speed intercity rail. 9 were studied, 6 were recommended. The Midwest Rail Initiative was one of those 6. This day, last week, I was in Quad Cities meeting with Davenport, Iowa, Moline, Illinois, and the other 2 associated communities on their transportation needs. They have the locks on the Mississippi. They have a need to expand their airport. They have highway transportation. They want to have high-speed rail connection to Chicago. They have a participating railroad, the Iowa something railroad, that is a short line service that is willing to partner with them to develop high-speed rail. St. Louis is excited about developing high-speed passenger rail connection to Chicago. St. Louis, with TWA and St. Louis as its hub, had nonstop service St. Louis to Heathrow Airport. Then Carl Icahn bought TWA and sold that route to American Airlines for $400 million, which they earned back in less than a year. And then he proceeded to deteriorate the airline, and eventually was forced out. And now TW has been acquired by American, so they have no hub. They want to have passenger rail service. They could have high-speed rail from St. Louis to O'Hare, in which you have a secure baggage car, screen your baggage, screen the passengers, secure the train, go directly to O'Hare, get frequent flyer miles for your rail travel, board your aircraft, fly to Heathrow, fly on to the continent, take the TGV and go to your destination in Europe, and get frequent flyer miles all the way. It makes sense. We need to do that. And Minnesota needs to be part of that partnership. Wisconsin's willing to do it. Illinois is willing to partner with us. Iowa wants to do this. So why doesn't Minnesota?
I think Representative Hausman is telling me that we're going to go for it.
We're doing it.
Congressman, 5 minutes ago, we may not have been doing it, but we are now. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hausman stole my thunder, so then I switched my question, and then Representative Hornstein stole my thunder, and in part of your answer, you stole my thunder. But
no, there's lots of thunder yet.
So I just thought I would mention to you, though, that in the bill that we just passed, because now we've managed to put some dollars on the table, some dedicated secure sources of funding for transit investments in the metropolitan area and the entire state. First time ever we put some serious money on the table. So now we can, you know, speak to the feds with a straight face saying, you know, we've got some dollars programmed now. We can do some capital matching and we can provide for the operating of these systems. One of the provisions that Senator Murphy advocated for and was passed in the bill was packaging up the four most promising lines that we've got on the books so that we can go to the FTA and say, you know, take a look at these four lines as a package. You know, they're the extension of North Star to St. Cloud, the Red Rock, Southwest Corridor, and the Rush Line. And it's a pretty exciting prospect that we can, instead of waiting 30-plus years to maybe bring a system together, we can maybe move forward quickly the way Denver has and Salt Lake City and others. So I just wanted to make sure you're aware of that, and we look forward to working with you and your staff as we try to package that up and bring it forward to D.C.
That's music to my ears, as was the vote. Hats off. I don't have a hat, but hats off to the legislature for doing the right thing. And those members who crossed over party lines deserve a medal, not a witch hunt, for what they did. Putting the public interest first, and as you said so well, Minnesota now has the funds, the revenues, the result of which will be that that currently Minnesota will be able to match $134 million in federal aid highway funds out of its $680 million entitlement for this year out of the Federal Highway Trust Fund. I negotiated a 46% increase in funding for Minnesota, the highest percentage increase of any state in the country in the current law. And Minnesota is on track, as Jesse Ventura was and did, to leave money in the Highway Trust Fund because the state would not be able to match if you didn't raise these additional dollars.
Well, thank you, Congressman, and thanks for mentioning the vote that was taken the other day. Now that we do have more resources on the table, I can tell you that a few things have changed. Acting Commissioner McFarland was here earlier. He had to slip out, but he's had conversations with both myself and Cheerleader in hoping to forge a better path. And Cheerleader and I are going to meet with some of the MnDOT folks and their planners, I believe Monday sometime, and kind of talk about the bill a little bit. But I think I might have underestimated Mr. McFarland a tad bit. It looks like he's going to tighten his belt up a little bit and tuck the ball under his arm and run like hell, and that's what we need. And I'm hopeful that we can forge a better Minnesota here.
I will say this for at least acting at the moment, Commissioner McFarland. He trained under a good man, Jim Den. Mm-hmm. Who was a splendid commissioner of transportation with whom I had a very constructive and productive working relationship. We had a good phone conversation yesterday. But I'll say here what I said then and just a moment ago on coming in, that one of the first challenges is to rebuild the personnel of the department. There's been an exodus of the most skilled engineering personnel from the Minnesota Department of Transportation, which once had a national reputation for having top-notch personnel. They've left. You have to either bring them back or replace them with skilled engineering professionals. The design and engineering community in Minnesota, the contracting community in Minnesota, has been telling me, we have nobody in the department to work with to oversee the projects that we're doing. We're confident we're doing a good job, but we need skilled professionals in the department to sign off on these projects or tell us when we're not doing things right. And we don't have that. We don't have that partnership. And that should be the first challenge. Rebuild the morale of this highly motivated Department of Transportation. Bring skilled personnel into it. Find a way to work with the communities in greater Minnesota and the metro area to use the funding that you've provided now, the dedicated revenue stream that will support transportation out into the future.
Thank you. We've got Senator Olsen, Salzman, Carlson, Representative Kalin, Representative Hortman.
So I have the mic.
Okay.
That's
Senator Salzman, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Congressman, we are honored to have you with us today on a very special week in Minnesota that is focused on transportation. And I represent the East Metro community, and thanks to Representative Leader, who showed extraordinary important leadership on this, was the portion of this bill that deals with bridge safety and really accelerating the worst of the worst bridges in this state. And representing the East Metro, three of them, the Hastings Bridge, which is not in my district but very close in Center Stevens, and the Stillwater St. Croix River Crossing and also the Lafayette, have been elevated into a Tier 1 status for funding. But what is disappointing is that the federal officials who represent two of these areas don't seem to be advocating for the federal funding for the Hastings and the Stillwater Bridge. We have heard discussions about against earmarking, and we have not earmarked funds in our bill, but we have developed a very strategic way of taking care of safety issues to ensure the public that they will be funded. So I wonder if you could speak to that, because I need an advocate. I'm speaking for my community today in that when we have residents who talk about rolling down their windows going across the bridge, and they truly are rolling them down because they're concerned. I see some of them here in the audience today. I'm concerned that we need to have a federal partner to make sure we have the funding to complete these. So I'm asking you is to explain earmarking, because I don't think this is earmarking. I think it's advocating for your community and making a case for the need. Would you be able to address that, please?
Of course. When the Federal Highway Administration says you need earmarks, that's usually an excuse for them not guiding you properly in the use of federal funds. All of the federal highway funds are distributed to the states according to a distribution formula that has certain categories of funding. One of those categories is bridges. And Minnesota's allocation for this year is just a little over $30 million. But states over the years have asked for the flexibility to shift dollars around among categories. And particularly in the bridge area, states in our T21 legislation in 1997 specifically wanted flexibility to shift those bridge dollars around. I was opposed to doing that, but as part of an overall package, I said, well, limit it to 50%. And guess what? Over the last 5 years, states have flexed, they call it, $4.5 billion out of their respective bridge accounts to other programs of transportation. Secondly, when there is a rescission, that is, after we do the appropriation process and the Department of or the Office of Management and Budget says, oh, no, we're not going to allow all those dollars to go. We're going to cut the allocation 10% for this department and for that department of government and so on. Then the state has the choice of what to do with their rescissions. The state of Minnesota has taken 43% of its reduction in funding under rescissions out of its bridge account. So the $30 million isn't enough to build a new bridge. It certainly is an amount available to upgrade existing bridges. And you can accumulate it year to year and invest it in one major project. Now, where an earmark we don't call it an earmark. We call them member high priority projects in the surface transportation bill to help members where their State Department of Transportation isn't responding to local needs. And members, through a very rigorous process, and designate projects, and then we have a formula for funding those. So we'll look to help you with that in the next transportation bill. But I would also point to the $626 million in equity bonus account funding the state of Minnesota has under the current transportation law. That's $626 million over 5 years in flexible money. This is bonus money that I brought to Minnesota to make up for the years when we weren't getting funding out of the Highway Trust Fund because we were using ethanol and it was tax exempt and we weren't getting credit in the Highway Trust Fund. I said, now it's payback time. Time for Minnesota to recoup what we've missed out on. And Minnesota has that money. And I don't know what they're doing with it, but I'm working on getting an accounting for it.
So I really appreciate that. And so just to share that message again, we do need federal help with these bridges. And if other members who represent these communities aren't willing to advocate, I am delighted to hear that you are, because we need leadership. Thank you so much.
There's one member out there who says he's not going to ask for earmarks. Well, shame on him, but I'll help you.
Thank you. Senator Olsen.
Well, Congressman, I'm not going to have a question. I'm going to have more of a thank you because, you know, I guess we're in the, you call us the Riviera of the 8th District, but what you've done over the years for Highway 8 with the safety improvements there that, you know, if we would have had to wait for state dollars, those projects probably would not be done now. And Commissioner Robinson from Chisago County is here, and as a former commissioner, we worked with you to build a bridge on 17. And it was always a pleasure to have you come out to the job site and see the process being done with the money that you were able to bring from Washington. And we bonded as a county. MnDOT, well, I believe there's $125,000 of state money in the park and ride. But that was basically a federal project in county bonding. So I just want to say thank you for what you've done in our district and throughout the state, actually.
Last year at this event, I congratulated the Chisago County Board for taking the initiative, going out bonding when the state refused to step forward and build this overpass, which is desperately needed when we replace the bridge on 95 over I-35 just north of 17. That has to be done as well. But as a result of citizen initiative on Highway 8, where 57 fatalities occurred in a 15-year period, and never once did MnDOT make that a priority, highway safety corridor priority. It was the citizens group, Nora Holt and others who came. And we had an all-night session, 8 in the evening till 1 in the morning. Bill Schreiber was there for Governor Carlson. Jim Den, the commissioner, was there, chief of the Minnesota Patrol. The district engineer was making, I think, roughly his first trip to Chisago County. sat through the meeting, and the result was, I said, design the safety improvements needed. I will designate them in the bill, and we did, and there hasn't been a fatality in 5 years. Well, there was one drunk who ran off the road.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Congressman, thank you very much for coming today also, and I'd like to go back to something you said earlier today, and then also you repeated it now, and that was about the feds subverting the law when they calculate the CEI.
Yeah,
we're about to embark on what I would say is a significant transit project here, going between downtowns, and what we're looking at is actually conflicting goals of trying to get ridership and trying to get speed between the downtowns. And everything that we discuss, you know, extra stops on University Avenue, well, the CEI won't allow it. Well, going to the Union Depot, well, the CEI won't allow it. Going underground at the university, well, the CEI won't allow it. It seems like all we're doing is compromising and compromising because of the CEI. And this is going to be the model that we're going to base practically all of our following projects on. And if we're looking at the CEI as being the enemy of getting a good 100-year plan here for this model, and you're saying that they're not following the law, is there something that we can do to get that law followed?
Well, the
bipartisan delegation from the state of Virginia and the District of Columbia tried. I in fact, convened a meeting of the Secretary of Transportation, the Federal Transit Administrator, Senator Warner, Senator Webb, Congressman Wolf, Congressman Davis, Congressman Jim Moran, previous two being Republicans, Governor Kane, and his Commissioner of Transportation, Dave Eckern, who was our Deputy Commissioner here in Minnesota for years, and laid it out for them. These are the factors that should – this was last August. These are the factors you need to consider. You're not following the law. You're not doing at Federal Transit what we directed you to do in the Safety Lou legislation. Consider the economic – consider what will happen when you go above ground and you have all the traffic tie-up in the morning and afternoon rush hours because of – learn from the Wilson Bridge traffic congestion and the cost to consumers. Factor that into your formula as the law says you should do. They are in total defiance of the law. And all that political horsepower hasn't been able to change this administration. Well, they're coming to the end of their rope. And come January 20th, a whole bunch of them, a whole lot of them are gone. And, but, I'm the chairman.
Well, that's,
and we got to fix it.
Thank you. That's and that is what I'm really concerned about is that, and exactly what you said, if we have – if everything's on the surface, and one of the things, one of the criticisms I agree with on the Hiawatha line is that automobiles and people and the train don't really mix well. And if we have this on the surface and every passenger on University Avenue has to cross traffic and maybe cross rails to get onto that train, it seems to me that we're going to have a lot of delays, a lot of interference, a lot of dead people, and we're going to hate that line and we'll never build another one.
And that can be avoided, and it should be avoided. And just to hold on, keep them going. You got to, unfortunately, got this Met Council. It's not very cooperative on this matter. They appear to be, but they're really dragging their feet. And come the next year, we'll rewrite that formula. We'll change things around. We're going to have a travel-friendly transit policy that's going to take into account the factors that create livable communities. And they're not doing that. They're not considering livable communities in applying their skewed view of the cost-effectiveness index. We're going to take that out and find something else.
Thank you.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Congressman, earlier in your remarks, as we look to the next federal transportation bill, you mentioned the importance of not relying on bonding too heavily, especially for roads. And I'd like to just give you an example as you make this point. Because of the bill we enacted on Monday, if you go north from the County Road 17 overpass to the North Branch Bridge that you mentioned briefly, it's a $21 to $22 million project. As you know, it's in the queue for 2012 or 2014, even though it's functionally obsolete, and it is impairing business growth in the community to the point where businesses will sit down and be very close to signing a deal, ask where the money is for the new bridge and what the timeline is, and literally hand the piece of paper back across the table and walk away and go to another community. This is happening not just in North Branch but around the state. We're changing that. We changed that on Monday. The initial assessment of this $22 million project, to move the project up 4 to 6 years, the city was going to have to do anticipatory bonding to pay for the debt service between in the difference of building starting this year or starting in 2014 of $4.2 million on the backs of property taxes. We believe, because of the initial readings of the bill, that we can build the project entirely with cash. So not only is that $4.2 million that our property tax payers won't have to bear, It's $4.2 million that no one will have to bear because it literally is cost savings on a $21 or $22 million project. It's a 17% return on our investment through a 2-cent literally the first 2 cents of that gas tax hike, we believe will remove that debt service requirement. I think it's a pretty powerful case as a fiscal conservative why the bill was the right move to do and why it's important from the federal level that we pay as you go and pay with a user fee and not rely more and more on bonding.
Right on. And, you could have well been one of the five co-authors of the Interstate Highway Program and the Highway Trust Fund. In 1956, when the Clay Commission, designated by General Eisenhower, made its report, they took General Clay took a report that was launched by President Roosevelt in 1944 of a study of what a transportation system would consist of post-World War II. And that report recommended 44,000-mile network. But in the rush to resettle the 16 million veterans and convert from a wartime to a peacetime economy and housing and education that was needed, transportation was neglected. But by 1953-54, it was clear highways were congested, our fatality rate was growing. If we didn't do something, we'd be killing 100,000 people a year on the nation's highways. So Eisenhower directed General Clay to upgrade that or update that report. The Clay Commission recommended a 42,500-mile system, $22 billion of investment, funded by a user fee. Well, George Humphreys was Eisenhower's Secretary of Treasury. He came from Wall Street, one of the biggest investment banking firms in Wall Street. He wanted to have a bonding mechanism to fund highway construction. And my predecessor, John Blotnick, was one of those five co-authors of the Interstate Highway Program. And he said, we all were shocked. We said, hell, we'd be paying twice. You pay for the highways, and then you pay Wall Street interest on those bonds. And we said, no, we're going to have a user fee, tax you pay at the pump, which was 3 cents. And that 3 cents passed. It was signed into law in June. By September, projects were underway. But by February of the next year, it was clear that 3 cents wasn't going to be enough. We needed another penny. And the House Ways and Means Committee brought to the House floor a bill to increase the highway user fee by 1 cent. It passed on a voice vote. You can't pass the prayer in the House on a voice vote today. That's the spirit that we need in this country. Now, fast forward today to the gas tax or user fee. 1 cent increase would yield $18.3 billion over 10 years. Just 1 cent nationally. That's a $1.7 billion in the first year and on from there. But you get it a year at a time. If you take a bonding proposal and you bond for that amount of money, $18.3 billion, you get $13.3 billion in the first year. Pretty good deal. But you're paying $5 billion in interest over the next 10 years. So instead of $18.3 billion, you really have only $13.3 billion. And you're paying interest to the bond merchants on Wall Street. That's not the right kind of investment to make. If you're a real fiscal conservative, you don't do that. And that's what you were saying. I'm sorry, Melissa, just go ahead.
Senator Hortman, or Representative Hortman, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Congressman Oberstar, I have a comment and then two questions. My comment is also a thank you for the funding for the 35W bridge. I wasn't on the group this summer or this fall that kept meeting to deal with the appropriations issues at MnDOT. But what struck me is that we were in this problem of giving MnDOT the authority to spend federal money that you got for us rather than having to find some money in our own state budget to replace that bridge. And I thank you so much because you know how far behind we were here in our transportation funding. If we would have had to rebuild that bridge out of our state budget,
and try to meet some of the needs that we have. We couldn't have done it. So thank you. And I don't think that we would be in the wonderful position that we are with the funding for that bridge if we didn't have the chair of the House Transportation Committee as our congressman. So thank you. And then my question is, the most important thing for me in January 2009 when the next president takes office is how that FTA is run, the Federal Transit Administration, and what the next president's view of the role of transit in our society is. And I was wondering if you had any comments on if you knew what the views are of the people who are running for president and how they value transit, if they value transit. Who do you have confidence in to put a great Federal Transit Administration into place? And then my second question is just the future of freight rail in this country and your comments on that.
Oh, well, an all-afternoon lecture right there.
Yes, and thank you very much for your thoughtful comments. I got the message about the collapse of the bridge while I was managing the conference report on the Water Resources Development Act to build those locks on the Mississippi and restore the wetlands in the Gulf and build a new lock at Sault Ste. Marie, dredge the harbors and channels on the Great Lakes. And then my BlackBerry buzzed, and I looked at it and said, what's this? A bridge collapse? Why are you telling me about a bridge? Where, in Tanzania or Central America? What? No, Minnesota. Oh, my God. So I made the announcement on the House floor. To his great credit, Jim Ramstad, who happened to be on the floor, came rushing over and said, we've got to do something now. We can't have another Katrina in Minnesota. And that night, that was 7 o'clock, the conference report vote passed. By 8 o'clock, I was meeting with committee staff, drafting three features of the legislation. One, waiving the $100 million national cap for emergency funding. Two, raising the $100 million limitation per state for emergency funding. And three, providing $5 million to the state of Minnesota, to the Metro Council, for a shift of people from road to transit. And by midnight, we had the bill drafted. I had a markup scheduled the next morning, Thursday, in committee, and I waived the bill out of subcommittee, moved it through full committee. We brought it up on the suspension calendar under a special rule. Unfortunately, two of our Minnesota delegation voted against, and passed the bill that Friday. $250 million, 100% federal funding. And then the governor and his lieutenant governor got themselves twisted around the axle, and they couldn't understand that the state has the responsibility to issue the contracts. The state pays the contractor, and the state then sends the voucher to the federal government. I explained it over the phone 3 times. They couldn't figure it out. Where's the money? I said, you have to start. That's how all highway projects work with federal funding. You issue the bids, award the contract, pay the contractor, submit the voucher to the federal government, then you get paid by email overnight in less than 48 hours. They couldn't figure it out. And finally, eventually, they came around. Second is on Mr. McCain's side, who's likely to be the Republican nominee, he's not been much of a transportation advocate. He hasn't been greatly involved in surface transportation. He's been an advocate for aviation, though only marginally. And on surface transportation, I've worked with him on the Motor Carrier Safety Act, where he was very supportive and very positive. But I don't know what his position would be on surface transportation funding, since he's not an advocate of taxes. We'll call it a fee. Maybe he'll support a fee. On the Democratic side, both Senator Obama and Senator Clinton have expressed their interest and support for a broader, greater investment in transportation and in infrastructure generally, but I haven't seen a specific plan, and I'm preparing with several of my colleagues. I'm going to take the lead on it and send a letter saying these are the things, these are
the infrastructure needs as we see them out into the future, and want you to commit to support robust investment in the nation's infrastructure, including water and sewer and sewage treatment plant renovation, and airports and airways and the air traffic control system, our ports and our inland waterways. Now, on freight rail, our freight rail system is approaching its capacity and has suffered from underinvestment, just as our surface highway transportation has suffered. During the years immediately following deregulation in 1980, which was not total deregulation, we vastly reduced the economic regulation of railroads, but did not completely eliminate federal role in moderating effects of competition, of concentration of economic power in the railroad sector on captive shippers. But as we went from 60 railroads in 1980 to four major railroads today and three sort of class two railroads, competition was virtually eliminated. Thousands of miles of rail roadway, were decommissioned. But now that freight is picking up by leaps and bounds. And the freight rails lack the actual railroad capacity, rail and ballast and ties and all the switches that all have to be in, committed. And last year, the railroads collectively earned $5.4 billion in net after-tax profit.
Really?
So they have the capital to invest now, and BNSF under Matt Rose is doing this. CSX is. The Canadian Pacific is probably the best run of the railroads in terms of management of personnel and hours of service. But it's roughly $2.6 million a mile for rail capital investment, and another $2 million per locomotive, another $500,000 per rail car for investment. So the railroads face a big challenge. They're also under pressure by hedge funds, which have invested in the Union Pacific and the CSX, taking very important ownership positions from which they can press the railroad to slow down its capital investment and put more money out to shareholders now that they have profits. But that will mean less investment in capital needs of railroads for the future.
Congressman, I think we've got about 2 minutes here. We're going to let Representative Ruth have the last question, and then we'll let you wrap up and be on your way. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Congressman, for coming. We really appreciate you taking time and to hear our concerns. And I'll try not to talk too fast, but I'm sure, as you know, many of us are very concerned about Highway 14, and the state has been very supportive and that we're getting it built, four lanes. So we're very, very, very thankful for that. We have the area between Mankato, funding up to, from Mankato up to Owatonna and Dodge Center to Rochester, but there's a piece from Owatonna to Dodge Center, and then also from Mankato to New Ulm. And we're told that Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation has told us that 80% of all businesses in Southern Minnesota are along Highway 14. So in addition to being a huge safety issue, it'll also be a huge economic boost for the people along that. We received $500,000, and we're thankful for that. But I'm wondering if there's any way that you could weigh in harder on Highway 14, because we could really use some federal help to finish that up.
I will be delighted to work with you. And is that in Tim Walz's district?
Congressman Walz, right.
Yeah, and with Mr. Walz, who serves on our committee on transportation, he will be greatly rewarded for his loyal service on that committee.
Thank you.
I would like to ask Senator Murphy and Chairman Leader whether Minnesota DOT has availed itself of the project streamlining provisions of the Safety Lou legislation. I crafted those provisions to speed up implementation of highway projects, to have a process by which we could do permitting in maybe 30 or 40 weeks rather than 30 or 40 months, to avoid the disaster. The only way to describe it we've had with the Stillwater Bridge. That's been underway for 20-some years. The original cost of that replacement bridge was slated at $30 million. It's now in the range of $300-plus million because all the snafus and the reruns and the reviews and the reconsiderations that have happened. And I've crafted a procedure by which all the environmental reviews, all the historical reviews, all the local permitting, whatever is subjected to permit, can be done without shortchanging the public interest, the interests of environment, the interests of historical preservation, but get the projects completed, including providing funding out of the Highway Trust Fund for those agencies that say, we don't have the personnel to do this work. Fish and Wildlife Service typically says, we don't have the people to do this work. So we'll say, no more excuse. We'll pay out of the Highway Trust Fund to hire that person to do the reviews that are necessary, complete the permitting. We've got to telescope this construction package we have into less time and put more money, especially when costs of steel and cement are being driven sky high by the vast appetite of China and India.
Congressman, I'm sure that on Monday when we have our meeting with Mr. McFarland and his staff that we'll get a rundown on that program and where they set at. The other thing that I might want to mention, you know, with the tragedy on August 1st, it did take away one of the major corridors that over 100,000 people used every day. But MnDOT went to work to rechannel that traffic, did some things that was very creative with the Met Council to help provide some expanded transit service. And this is along the lines of trying to expedite projects that, Congressman, and for the folks that are sitting here listening, we're going to have to shut down complete roadways when we fix them in the future because this fixing them willy-nilly a little piece at a time just – you know, the guy's got his finger on the till, and he's just ringing up dollars. If we can take what would normally be 24 months and turn it into 15 months of construction with a completed project, we save a lot of money. And, you know, you see that around here in the metropolitan area. We're going to have to re-divert traffic and take down major things like unweave the weave or cross town and just clean them up, get them off the books, and move to the next project. So, Congressman, once again, we appreciate you being here and all the work that that you do on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
I want to congratulate the House and the Senate for putting the public interest first, investing in Minnesota's future, passing solid legislation that will put us on course to investment in a productive and competitive transportation system for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman. Committee adjourned.